Hi, this is State Delegate Janelle Wilkins from District 20 in Montgomery County, and you're listening to the Conduit Street Podcast, the best source of news and notes on Maryland politics and policy. The Conduit Street Podcast, the official podcast of the Maryland Association of Counties.
Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. This is Michael Sanderson from the Maryland Association of Counties. It is a new year and we are ready to deliver even more policy and politics that affects all of us here and across the free state of Maryland. It's a new year, new session is kicking off, and I've got Brianna January from our team with me to talk about it. Welcome, Brianna.
Hi, good to be with you today, Michael. Glad to join in. And well, I don't know about our listeners, but we are already feeling it. Session is well underway over at Conduit Street. And I mean, our listeners can't tell, but we can tell because we're actually recording this on a Wednesday. It's the first day of session, January 10th, and people are back in town. We haven't seen Annapolis like this in a few months.
but seeing Annapolis has an asterisk this year, like, you know, we're prepared for the session. We're prepared for the return of the senators and delegates and all the other folks who are part of the whole apparatus of session. What we weren't prepared for was this crazy storm that ran through the whole state, left us, I don't know, like knee deep in water in big parts of downtown Annapolis, down by the city dock and so forth. So
I thought I was going to have to borrow a canoe to come in this morning.
I know last night it was looking dicey, and I mean, we'll have a lot of local businesses and families who are going to have some recovery to do and that sort of stuff. So I'm sure, you know, that'll be on everybody's minds, but the show must go on. So the session is upon us. We just got a chance to listen to the gaveling in of the two chambers, the installation of the officers and so forth. So both the House and Senate are up and running and ready to roll.
Ready to roll. Here we are. But yeah, it's going to be a fun and interesting session. That's for sure.
Yeah. So like, I guess like to set the stage a little bit, especially for anyone who might be a new listener or kind of new to this whole cycle, it's the first day of a 90-day legislative session. And also importantly, that this is year two of a four-year political cycle, that not every state does it this way, but here in Maryland, the entire state legislature stands for election once every 4 years at the same time as our governor and our statewide elected officials. So the folks who are in the state legislature just won election back in 2022. They sat for their first session in 2023. That's always a little bit of, I don't know, part of the expression, but kind of a training wheels year that a lot of the members are just sort of, you know, if you're a new member to the House and Senate, you sort of have to figure out how the flow works and the committee system and the protocol and the process for introducing bills and working with co-sponsors and doing amendments. There's like a bunch of process to it. So you kind of get a red shirt your first year in sports terms, but this is year two of the four-year cycle. And most of us around town expect that that's going to mean things should feel like a little more normal here in year two.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, last year there was so much change. We had a ton of new members in town following that 2022 election. Like you were saying, Michael, it's almost like starting a new job and kind of condensing your entire first year into 90 days. So we're talking about people literally trying to find the bathrooms around town. They're trying to make policy and law. And we also had a new administration, you know, a new governor, lieutenant governor, their whole cabinet and staff. So folks were definitely trying to find their footing last year for the most part. People stayed under the radar. It felt at times like it could get a little crazy last session, just with the kind of policy that we were dealing with. But instead, it was kind of slow moving in some ways and not as groundbreaking as folks may have thought.
Yeah, I think I'm guilty of making a poor prediction, you know, back in, I guess, you know, December of 22, January of 23. I kind of thought it would be a nutso session, that year one with a brand new administration and so many new leaders and rank and file members of both chambers. I really felt like, boy, it'll be a big shakeup. It's a good thing that Mako is a sort of, you know, longstanding, well-grounded organization, that our reputation is more than just the last few years or friendships with a few people or whatever. But I think I misjudged things. Last year was a little more like the usual first year of a term, you know, wobble along a little bit. I guess, you know, one thing that's kind of built in is, you know, the governor isn't even sworn in until the middle of January. He has to introduce a budget 1 week later and is still in the process of appointing and locating leaders for state agencies and you know, the high-ranking roles in the administration. So I think this is sort of a structural outcome of the way Maryland does the calendar. You get elected, you have a window of time to get the house in order, but you end up with not quite as much coming from the state agencies and administration in the early part of the session that might be the case this year. So yeah, I'm with you. Generally speaking, I think this will be more of a normal year and we'll probably pick up the pace relative to last year. I expect there'll be more stuff going on. In addition, there's more intrigue with fiscal issues and the budget and whatnot. So there's other reasons for that, but just structurally, year two should be hotter pace than year one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and not to have our listeners think that last year was a light year. It wasn't by any means. I mean, we did have, what, like 2,275-ish bills total, 1,300 over in the House, like another 1,000 and some over in the Senate. I mean, we at MAKO analyzed, I don't know, probably a good 1,000 of those ourselves,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah, close to 1,000. We got into our database, reading through to, you know, to look through whether this would require, you know, follow through on the local governments or whether we would be doing the enforcement or whether we're subjected to a new thing. So yeah, we picked up nearly 1,000 bills to analyze. I know you had a big sliver of those.
I did. Any predictions on where you think we'll land for this year with bill numbers wise? I mean, we're already hearing that the bill drafting office is just bombarded, flooded, not to have the pun for Annapolis today, but flooded with requests, and that they're already over, you know, 200 pre-filed bills over in the House that are now available online. There's over 300 in the Senate. A lot of those are not cross files. So, I mean, we're looking at quite a few already. What is your guess for bill numbers for this year?
Yeah, I mean, I know that I've been at the table testifying on bills with a House number in the 1500s or 1600s. Oof. and Senate, you know, well, you know, like in the 1100s and 1200s in years past. So if last year was 2275 was the total, I'll take the over on that. But I mean, I might guess, you know, if you're a sports person, you're used to looking at an over under number, and I might set the over under for this year at, say, how about 2650? I think we'll have hundreds more bills than last year. So yeah, buckle up.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, all of those folks that were finding the bathrooms last year have now found their way to the bill drafting office and have things in for consideration this year.
Right. And there is sort of this annual ritual that's already started. Yeah, you mentioned the number of bills that seem to already be piling up with the professional staff who are bill drafters. So typically what happens is, if you're a delegate or you're a senator or you're an advocate for an issue and you're working with friendly legislators, you might be walking around with like a piece of paper that says, we want to do a bill that does these four things, or you got bullet points or something like that. Well, you need someone to actually convert that from understandable English bullet points into legislative language with all the brackets and capitalization and bolded and, you know,
the less
like
understandable.
There's this wonky, you know, nerdy language that those of us speak who are in like bill language. So the process of doing that, you know, you drop off your paperwork with a team of professional bill drafters. They get to work on turning it into a proper piece of legislation. So that's what's going on in the first few weeks of the session. We're already hearing the bill drafting office saying, oh my gosh, we're overwhelmed with bill requests. And then the next step is always, okay, everybody, members, get your bills in early, or else you might not have them on time if you don't get your bill back from bill drafting on time for the proper submission date. Then you're not guaranteed to get a public hearing. So there's an incentive to do stuff quickly. And usually both the speaker and president kind of you know, give some urgency to this early in session to their members.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there has to be some structure when we're talking about, you know, 2,500 bills potentially for a session and 90 days for hearings, voting sessions, work sessions, everything to be figured out. But, you know, one of my favorite parts about session, I think, is that kind of ritual, that walking around, getting input from different stakeholders, different members of leadership, different agencies, getting those co-sponsors. You know, it's a big part of the game. And it's really a lot of how you get the political buy-in to move your bill at all, even before you have a public hearing. And, you know, that's quickly where we'll see folks heading into kind of that political gaming, if you will, as session continues.
Yeah, it's a little strange. I sometimes feel bad when a school sends a class of fourth graders on a trip to Annapolis so that their students can see democracy in action. And what they want to do is get the kids up in the gallery to watch the Maryland Senate take the floor. And if you do that, like in the month of January, what generally is happening is very little action on the floor of the House and Senate, because the early part of the session is, like you said, it's that I want to refine my bill. I want to see if I can answer some questions and change my bill to avoid getting opposition at its bill hearing. Then later in session, it's going to be those bills are going to be heard and discussed in the committees rather than on the floor. And it's bills that make it out of committee when you get to like about halfway through the session, things start heating up on the floor of the Senate, on the floor of the House, as there's debate over the things that are advancing out of the committee process. But this early session part of the 90 days is an important part of the gig, even though it looks like nothing's happening. If you just watch a 20-minute session on the Maryland Senate, they read across a few bills, they get a benediction from a religious figure or something like that, they congratulate a championship volleyball team or something like that, and then it's off to your committees you go. Seems like nothing's happening, but the gears are turning in the early part of session for sure.
For sure. It's definitely that iceberg effect, everything going on under the surface that the general public is not privy to.
It's 90-10 right now. That's for sure. So, okay. So Brianna, your portfolio ranges across a number of areas, and, you know, MACO has a lot of ground to cover. And the way we kind of do so is by having some specialization across our staff. So you work on education issues, both sort of funding and operations and deliverables in the school systems and the way counties fund and support education. Also connected to education, school construction and buildings and so forth, whether it's schools, but also other capital projects and so forth. And you're also connected with a number of our labor issues with our workforce and that sort of stuff. All of these are hot topics. All of these are big areas. Some of these things we've kind of talked a lot about on the podcast over the last few months. We know big picture school funding is a top line issue. I think we've talked about that sort of stuff, but let's take a minute and dive in onto maybe a few issues that you see getting some attention and some oxygen this legislative session that you anticipate being in committee, talking to legislators about, working with our county elected officials and trying to guide MACO to be productive and you know, benefit from what's happening in Annapolis. So what's on your mind in your portfolio that our listeners might want to hear about?
Yeah, well, Michael, I don't know about you, but I don't expect to be busy at all this session. I think, you know, education, workforce, come on. There's nothing to be had there.
I couldn't keep the straight face. Sorry. I broke the facade there.
Quite the opposite. So there's been a back and forth about whether or not there will be anything of substance when it comes to the blueprint. We can definitely have a follow-up conversation, I think, in a few weeks' time when we know more about where that stands. Everyone has an interest and a priority there. But the action on what's going to happen, if anything, is kind of unclear still. What I do think that there might be some significant action on is early childhood education in particular. You know, across the country and here in Maryland and the DMV area in general, we've really felt the impact of the pandemic for the childcare industry, everyone closing for health and safety reasons. And then, of course, the workforce shortages related to childcare. And now we have the blueprint, which one of its core pillars is to expand pre-K for all Maryland 3 and 4 year olds over the next few years. And a big portion of that is to hopefully get the private childcare industry to kind of come into the fold and start to offer pre-K as well. So that way more Maryland kids are serviced in universal pre-K. But what we're finding is that with the post-pandemic environment of workforce being just absolutely decimated in this area, plus folks still have some health considerations around, you know, lots of little kids in a pre-K space and whether or not you want to expose yourself or your families. And then there's also just the complications around startup and sustainability for this sort of industry. They're really difficult to sustain financially. So you're hearing a lot of people talk about what that means for the blueprint for pre-K expansion and where folks stand. So, you know, we'll see if something happens, but I think that one of the top things on everyone's mind when we talk about education in general is what we're doing with early childhood.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's going to draw a good deal of attention. I mean, on the education side of what do we do with and for our 3 and 4 year olds? I mean, this was a pretty central pillar of mm-hmm. of the blueprint vision back when it was the Kerwin Commission studying what things should Maryland do to take big, bold next steps in education. An awful lot of momentum and a lot of scholarship behind the idea that catching as many kids as possible when they're 3 and 4 years old and getting them into a more academic than just a supervisory or, you know, creative or guided play role mm-hmm. is really helpful for a lot of kids, especially those who don't have some of the support structure at home that you would prefer. So anyway, like the idea of providing universal pre-K or at least an offering of pre-K to all students, starting with poor kids and working your way out from there, was a pretty big part of the Kerwin plan and part of the blueprint. But you're right, we just don't have, like, things haven't come together the way we might have wanted or expected them to. And who knows how much of that is the pandemic and the world kind of changing in a variety of subtle ways. Or maybe it's just we miscalculated on how the private daycare universe might feel about transitioning to becoming true educators and getting staffed up and trained up to take on a broader mission than just like watching the kids. So I think that like that's an unknown. We physically don't have space in the public school world to put every 3 and 4 year old into behind a desk. Right. So that's where we are a few years into this whole plan is we need to do some like almost lateral thinking on where's the space, who are the providers, who are the teachers, how much of this is old school in the public building with a public employee as a teacher, and how much of this would look different but accomplish the same goals. So I agree with you. There's a reckoning due there. And then like just in general on childcare, I mean, I don't know, we at our winter conference back in December, we had a closeout session talking about challenges of getting people employed in the public sector. And mm-hmm. one of the speakers on the panel from St. Mary's County was saying they've built a whole new facility. It's a childcare yeah. facility just for county workers, for their employees. To basically say, yes, you can take a job with us and we've got a place where your kids can be watched after and safe in a supervised environment. And they're just using it as a hiring tool, which, you know, 15 years ago would be more or less unthinkable that you would right. invest in that kind of expense, that kind of a luxury. But now it's a matter of it's a way to attract employees who might not otherwise be able to take a job with you. So, yeah, I think all this stuff is front and center.
Yeah. And Michael, that example is for a county with, you know, maybe a few hundred employees. So imagine the counties that have a few thousand, the type of considerations yeah. that, you know, around family dynamic and childcare. But I mean, that leads us right into what I think is going to be another big area for session, as it always is. And that's workforce development. I mean, we will likely see some bills on especially the public workforce. I think, just this week, there was a task force report that basically outlined the different steps and major policy reforms that the state should take to improve its own hiring at the state level. We've had for years now really high rates of state vacancies. There's still like 6,600 or nearly 7,000 state jobs that are unfilled. And if you add in the University of Maryland and some other independent agencies, it's even higher. It's close to 10,000, according to this report. So it's not just at the local level. We're feeling this pinch when it comes to public sector workforce, really at all levels. And it's really starting to get the attention of legislators and of even the administration. We saw some of Governor Moore's major initiatives last year, when it was his first year, was around public workforce development. And I think that it's going to continue to be a conversation this year for session.
Yeah. I looked over that report as well, and there's some eye-popping numbers there with, you know, vacancies in state government and in the public sector, and like just the difficulty we've been having in the public side of the workforce, just recruiting and retaining. There's a variety of jobs that jump out, like trying to find people who want to serve as a correctional officer at a state facility or at a county jail, just sure. Brutal. And yeah. our local wardens will tell you that, you know, I had two jobs opening in 2007 and I had 44 applications. Right now I got 7 jobs open and they've been sitting open for 18 months. And every time one person applies, we talk to her, but we don't have a stream of applicants like we once did. Another thing that I thought was interesting in that report is, and this kind of got some headlines, like the hiring process itself in the public sector seems like it's an impediment. And I think we're probably going to see legislation and probably some administrative changes to change that. I studied public administration, back when I was in school and so forth. And I remember academics talking about, this is kind of a pendular effect that we go back and forth between efficiency and sort of clarity and transparency and ethics. Mm-hmm. And I think the public sector is full of that as kind of a tension that you want to make sure in the hiring process, you don't want to have, you know, the county commissioner hires his niece or, you know, the people who are whatever from the right political party or who helped on a campaign all suddenly just get a whole bunch of jobs, like the old school patronage system. Like, you don't want that to be the way public hiring works. So you want to have a civil service process. You want to make sure there's accountability and, you know, checks and balances through that process. But then you get a report like this that says the state has an open job and decides they want to fill it. And 6 months later, the paperwork still isn't done to get the right person into the job. And like, nobody should feel like that's a good outcome. I mean, you can be really pro process and pro transparency and pro ethics and also be frustrated at 6 or 8 months being the regular timetable to just hire a person to answer the phones or to, you know, to walk the aisle at the jail. Right. That's just, you know, you got to find some balance there. That pendulum might need to swing back a bit. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you want the right people in the jobs, of course, but the balance of getting them into the position in time where they can actually do the work and do good for Marylanders is of concern. And I mean, I recently read that in the state, it takes on average like 4 or 5 months to fill a position. So imagine that times 7,000 for right. current opening. Yeah. It's just... I can't imagine. It's a lot. It's a lot to fill. But yeah, I think that we might see some more work on newish state programs to help with public sector hiring and just backfilling roles, but also strengthening the pipelines so that way there isn't such right. high vacancy rate, you know, start right. getting into our colleges and community colleges and K-12s a bit sooner.
Yeah. And in line, the background of all these issues is going from a vacant position to a filled position requires some cash money to be able to pay the new person occupying that position. And we've already gathered that the order of the day is fiscal prudence and instability, softness in our revenues. So that's an extra, you know, sort of an exacerbating factor in a challenging issue anyway. So, okay, you know, we got our hands full in the budget and with personnel policies and maybe some legislation. So it's worth keeping an eye on. I think that'll be a real issue through this session. I'm with you there.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, talking about money, we've seen consistently the last few years, several bills at a time really targeting capital projects, targeting public buildings, whether it's literally your county courthouse that the public's using and operating in, down to just the buildings that the state uses to function, the Department of Legislative Services, the professional staff, county professional staff, all of the above that are public spaces. We've seen a lot of bills targeting not just how we construct and renovate, but also the types of materials. Lots of folks are looking to green our infrastructure in Maryland to require that we use what's considered to be more sustainable or better for the environment type of materials and practices and all of that good stuff. So I think that talking about money, capital projects are not quite what they used to be. And I think that we can probably expect that some of that will come back again this year. And of course, for county governments, we're talking about not just our buildings, and things like the courthouses, the libraries, but we're also talking about all of our public schools, which is quite a chunk of change to consider.
Yeah, a really big footprint on the capital budget universe for public schools. And it's a beast that we simply don't have the capacity to overfeed. I mean, even with a sort of an accelerated school funding program over the last few years, layered on top of the usual commitment through the state's capital bonds to build schools, there are always renovations, new schools, expansions that are merited, that by the numbers, you know, we have the kids who are in temporary facilities, they're in trailers, and we'd rather put them into a permanent facility, or they're in schools that are 40, 50, 60 years old and really are in need of renovation or replacement. It's an endless crusade to try and do right by the places where kids are going to learn.
New pre-K classes, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. I mean, exactly. As we didn't even need that as a complex extra layer, but maybe that's there too. Maybe we will do some building as part of addressing that issue as well. But we've got our hands full already with the K through 12 even. I will say one thing that's kind of an extra layer of difficulty, like one more twist on the dive. If you think of that like degree of difficulty thing they do in the Olympics, like the extra twist in capital right now is that the bond market is different than it was even like a couple of years ago. For the sure. State of Maryland as a like really good credit risk with like the high end AAA by every rating agency and about as good of a risk as you can take. And it's a municipal bond, meaning that if you're a big hitter investor, you won't even pay income taxes on the interest you make on the bond. So like we used to be able to borrow money at 2.5% interest or in that neighborhood, you know, really low rate borrowing. But the interest rate market has changed as everybody who's been trying to buy a house recently has realized suddenly you buy a house at a 7 or 8% mortgage. If you have a few dollars to invest, you can walk down to the bank and they'll give you a CD at 5%, where 2 years ago that was probably more like 0.5% or 1%. Just expectations on interest rates change. So the whole bond market moves with that, which means the state of Maryland wants to float, you know, whatever, $600 million, $800 million worth of bonds to help pay for capital projects. Lo and behold, like those are going to be like 4%, 4.5%, 5% bonds instead of the olden days when you could borrow at 2% and change. So that's a difference maker too, just in what you've got to book for interest costs, for debt service down the road. It's not quite as cheap of a date to do capital projects as it once was.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, we can also add a couple of other layers and talk about labor costs and shifting labor market trends and whether or not we have the labor available to do these sort of projects to begin with. But, you know, Michael, I think I'm getting a bit of a headache for this being the first day of session.
Well, I mean, it's the nature of the kind of stuff we do. It's a 90-day session. It's like a super accelerated timeline. And for folks who haven't been through it, Yeah, if you've ever read descriptions of what it's like to be stuck in a black hole where you lose a sense of time and space and there is no escape and
personhood,
there's weird distortions and all this kind of stuff, I sometimes think the 90-day session in Annapolis is a little bit like that. That once you're on the inside, it's just a one-way trip to the 90th day. Thankfully, Maryland is one of the states where we do not, on the regular, have unusual things that leave us in an extended or overtime session. We sometimes have a two-day special session in the summer to tidy up a thing or that. That's like once every 3, 4, 5 years. But usually, you can pretty much circle that Monday in April, the 90th day. It's going to be midnight. They're going to drop the confetti. Everybody's going to shake hands. A bunch of bills die. Everything's cool. And we move on from there. So, you know, here we are, day one. We're ready for 90 days of this. It feels like a lot already. It's going to overwhelm us all in the weeks ahead, but that's, I don't know. I still like it. I confess, I still like it.
Oh, I was giddy like a little kid waiting for the first day of school last night. I could barely sleep. I'm ready. Let's do it.
Yeah. I saw you posted one of those, you know, one of those finger drumming emojis or whatever on on social media. So like I think we're cut from the same cloth there. You almost have to be to do this kind of stuff. So
for sure. We're the same breed, I think.
Yeah, I think that's about it. So, all right, let's wrap it up there. Listeners, if you are new to this podcast, absolutely welcome aboard. We're going to run an episode pretty much every Friday all year, all through the session and all year long. We don't just cover county issues, but I don't know, let's face it, nearly all the things our Maryland residents care about is something that's being delivered or supported by counties. So we really have a lot of so-called county stuff to keep us going and keep interested, but we'll cover politics, policy, and all that kind of stuff from Annapolis. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe. That way, every episode will be sent right to the device of your choice. And why not go ahead back to your service and give us that 5-star rating? That's the best way to let other folks know what we're doing here and what we're talking about. Why not? Follow us on social media, including Mako's own Conduit Street blog, where we cover news and analysis all through the session and all year long. More of this kind of stuff, even above and beyond. So for Brianna January, for our producer Chantel Malcolm Lim, and the whole Mako team, this is Michael Sanderson. We will talk to you soon.